print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the July 30th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: Fed officials held interest rates steady in a range of 3.5% to 3.75% over the objections of three bank presidents who wanted an increase. Major U.S. stock indexes fell after Fed Chair Kevin Warsh showed some reluctance to raise rates. The S&P 500, Dow, and NASDAQ shed 1.5%, 2.2%, and 1.7% respectively. Oil prices surged more than 7% after a fresh round of fighting across the Middle East undermined efforts to end a five-month-old conflict. Meta Platforms reported record revenue for the second quarter, but the company's performance contained signs that AI spending may be weighing on its business. Microsoft reported robust cloud growth and a boost in the number of paid artificial intelligence subscribers, saying revenue increased 18% in the quarter ended in June. General Dynamics reported higher profit and revenue for the second quarter as performance improved across all of the defense company's business lines. Qualcomm's third quarter profit fell, hurt by lower sales and higher memory cost, and the company gave a soft outlook for the current quarter. Health insurer Humana cut its earnings outlook for the year as the company continues to face headwinds from lower Medicare Advantage star ratings for 2026. Boston Scientific cut its full-year outlook after revenue from its Watchman heart implant slowed and its electrophysiology business ran into fiercer competition. Deutsche Bank said it would buy back shares for the equivalent of $569.3 million after booking a rise in profit that exceeded market expectations. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. The U.S. began launching strikes on Iran in retaliation for Tehran's missile attacks against American U.S. forces in Jordan, as hopes were dashed for a quick diplomatic breakthrough. The Pentagon earmarked more than $120 billion for contractors to step up production of Patriot missiles and long-delayed submarines to support future combat operations. A Senate committee vote on confirming Trump's nomination of Todd Blanche as Attorney General was postponed as the administration struggled to win over holdout Republicans. Anthony Fauci repeatedly invoked the Fifth Amendment as the longtime government scientist declined to answer questions in a heated Senate hearing on the pandemic. Russia charged Telegram founder Pavel Durov with abetting terrorism for allegedly disregarding how Ukraine uses the platform to plan attacks in Russia. A federal judge sided with New Jersey, ruling that the state doesn't have to turn over its unredacted voter rolls to the Trump administration. Two New Jersey men and a Washington State man, accused of plotting to support Islamic State, pleaded guilty to terrorism-related offenses. Searchers in Kosovo inspected what could be a mass grave of people missing since the 1998-99 separatist war with Serbia. Trump and the Justice Department asked the Supreme Court to toss an $83 million defamation verdict won by writer E. Jean Carroll after she accused him of sexual assault. A Wisconsin appeals court restored a 2011 anti-union law that abolished collective bargaining rights, and unions are expected to appeal the decision to the state's Supreme Court. Ireland's economy returned to growth in the 3 months through June, boosting hopes for a pickup across the Eurozone as a whole, where activity stagnated in the first quarter. Died Glenn Hansard, 56, Irish singer-songwriter. The picture on today's front page shows Dr. Anthony Fauci seated at what appears to be a Senate hearing. And that caption reads, "Takes the Fifth." Dr. Anthony Fauci, who led the U.S. response to the COVID-19 pandemic, repeatedly invoked his Fifth Amendment rights before a Senate committee hearing, which he said he believed was part of a slander campaign against him. And that headline, "Fauci refuses to answer senators' COVID queries." The article, "Fauci invokes Fifth Amendment at hearing." GOP senators press doctor on COVID in heated appearance after journal's release. By Liz Esley White and C. Ryan Barber, Washington. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the longtime government scientist who became the face of the U.S. response to the COVID-19 pandemic, repeatedly invoked the Fifth Amendment on Wednesday amid a barrage of heated questions and sharp accusations on Capitol Hill. Fauci faced the Senate committee hearing after the recent release of his journals shed new light on his handling of the crisis. Senate Homeland Security Committee Chairman, Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, whose office released the journals, issued a subpoena in June to require Fauci's testimony after the infectious disease doctor declined to appear willingly. "On the advice of counsel, I respectfully declined to answer," Fauci said, citing his Fifth Amendment rights, a response he gave more than 100 times during the three-hour hearing. Paul said the documents he released showed Fauci wasn't forthright with the American public about school closings, the origins of the COVID virus, and more. "You did not tell the American people the full story," he said. Paul also warned of repercussions for the doctor's refusal to answer questions. "It's against the law to obstruct an investigation of Congress," Paul said. Ahead of the hearing, Paul had warned that a preemptive pardon issued by former President Joe Biden wouldn't protect Fauci if he were to lie to Congress. The pardon covered any federal offenses committed between January 2014 and January 19, 2025, related to Falsey's government role. Like any presidential clemency action, it didn't foreclose future congressional investigation or state-level charges. Falsey, 85, told senators on Wednesday that he had testified or briefed congressional committees more than 200 times, but would decline to answer their questions because he believed the hearing was part of a campaign of slander against him. Falsey accused Paul of having an unhinged obsession with him. Quote, the sole reason he is calling me before this committee is to get me to say something, anything, that could vindicate his repeated public pledges that I end up behind bars. Paul has called for Falsey to be imprisoned and wrote a book titled Deception, The Great COVID Cover-Up, with Falsey's face featured on the cover. The accusations that Chairman Paul continues to propagate are false and disgraceful, and we will examine all options to hold him accountable, Falsey's lawyer, David Schertler, said in a statement. The hearing was briefly disrupted when Paul refused to allow Falsey's lawyer to speak and ordered security to remove him from the room. The hearing revealed the stark polarization over Falsey's legacy and the controversy that still surrounds his actions years after his retirement from the federal government in 2022. Senator Rick Scott, Republican from Florida, called him a villain, while Senator Maggie Hansen, Democrat from New Hampshire, said the doctor had a distinguished career trying to put America's public health first. Fed stands pat with three dissents. Dissenters back a rate increase amid elevated inflation. Stocks fall sharply. Chairman Kevin Warsh said the Fed didn't have a magic wand that would be able to bring inflation down quickly. By Nick Timiraos, Washington. Federal Reserve officials held interest rates steady Wednesday over the objections of three bank presidents who wanted an increase, underscoring how pressure is building inside the central bank to act on inflation that has run above its target for 5 years. The Fed held its benchmark rate steady in a range of 3.5% to 3.75% in a 9-3 vote. The rate-setting panel issued the same policy statement as it did in June, when it also held rates steady. The decision left Chairman Kevin Warsh's vow to end the run of above-target inflation to rest for a second straight meeting on words rather than action. The three Fed presidents who voted for a quarter-point rate hike, Beth Hammack of Cleveland, Neil Kashkari of Minneapolis, and Lori Logan of Dallas, had opposed in April the decision to issue a statement that suggested a rate cut was more likely than an increase. It was the first time since 2016 that three officials dissented in the same direction over a policy change. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. U.S. strikes back at Iranians for attack on Jordan, by Lara Sigelman, Philip Wegman, and Vera Bergengruen. American forces began launching strikes against Iran on Wednesday night in what the U.S. military called a powerful response to Iran's missile attacks on U.S. forces in Jordan. The strikes came hours after President Trump vowed to retaliate for the surprise ballistic missile strike, dashing hopes for an imminent diplomatic breakthrough. Though the assault was larger in scope than previous U.S. attacks, it did not amount to a return to major combat operations, according to a U.S. official. U.S. forces attacked dozens of targets, including military command centers, missile and drone facilities, coastal surveillance and defense sites, and maritime capabilities, said U.S. Central Command. The strikes aimed to further diminish threats posed by Iran and its proxies to American forces, commercial shipping, and the neighboring Gulf countries, the command said. We are going to be hitting them very hard, Trump said in the Oval Office on Wednesday, because it's our turn. Iran's unprompted attack on U.S. troops shattered a brief ceasefire after both sides paused strikes on Friday in order to give negotiations a chance to hammer out an arrangement for ships to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. The Trump team had hoped those talks, which collapsed on Tuesday, would cool tempers and juice negotiations for a broader agreement. Iran carried out its attacks on Jordan hours after the end of the discussions. While Tuesday's missile attack was successfully intercepted, the barrage intensified pressure on the president to respond and threatened to once again restart hostilities as the war with Iran enters its sixth month. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth in Washington on Wednesday as the Trump administration weighed its next move. In a White House meeting on Tuesday, Trump and Netanyahu did what a senior Israeli official called a clinical review of three strategies toward Iran: a diplomatic agreement, intensifying economic pressure and ramping up the blockade, or renewing military action. U.S. and Israeli officials weighed cost and timelines for each. Netanyahu didn't express a preference for any of the options and told Trump it was his decision, the Israeli official said. He told Trump that diplomacy could be pursued alongside greater economic pressure, such as restricting Iran's overland trade routes while negotiations continue. Hours after the Iranian strikes on Jordan, the U.S. military said that American and Saudi aircraft launched strikes against Iran-backed groups in Iraq. A senior Jordanian government official said five missiles were intercepted in Jordan's eastern desert and caused no injuries or material damage. The official declined to comment on the specific targets of the missiles. U.S. troops are posted to a Jordanian base near the Syrian border and at a separate air base in the desert, where an Iranian missile strike killed three U.S. service members this month. The Jordanian officials said the Iranian attack showed the region is undergoing dramatic change. The attack illustrates a fundamental shift in which Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has grown more assertive and more comfortable with a state of war that could continue for months, rather than enter into a peace in which it would have to face public dissatisfaction with Iran's struggling economy and a lethal clampdown on protesters this year, analysts say. The U.S. and Israeli bombing campaign against Iran that began 5 months ago ended decades in which Iran and the IRGC preferred to keep its actions against the U.S. and Israel in the shadows, working through the regional militia groups and avoiding direct conflict. With the regime's survival on the line, Iran has launched waves of missiles and drones against U.S. forces in several neighboring countries. Meta's AI spending missed forecast hit shares. Meta is trying to prove to investors it can make money in the near term. By Megan Brabowski. Meta Platforms investors tuned into the company's second quarter earnings call, hoping to hear reassuringly specific answers about how much more the company expects to spend on artificial intelligence and how it plans to monetize that investment. Failing to hear them, they punished the social media company's stock, sending it down more than 10% in after-hours trading. Meta announced record revenue for the second quarter, but an update on the company's AI spending plans and the shrinking of free cash flow to less than $1 billion heightened scrutiny on the cost of its infrastructure build-out. On a call with investors and analysts, Meta Chief Executive Mark Zuckerberg said the company has quite a number of offers from companies to buy its excess computing power at a premium, but that its immediate focus is on using that capacity on its own endeavors. Meta's performance for the quarter contained signs of AI spending creating drag on its business. Free cash flow, which exceeded $12 billion in the first quarter, dwindled to less than $784 million, although it did not descend into negative territory as analysts had forecast. Net income fell by 14% from a year earlier. Morgan Stanley pushed bankers to approve client mortgages. At Morgan Stanley, tension exists between financial advisors and mortgage employees. By Anna Maria Andriotis. Inside Morgan Stanley's private bank for the ultra-wealthy, over the past year, an employee in the mortgage lending department tried to question how a client kept applying for new home loans, claiming he would be living in the residences. The client had received several owner-occupied loans in just a few years, and the banker was objecting to a new one, people familiar with the matter said. Those mortgages often come with lower interest rates and require smaller down payments for the borrower than second homes or investment properties would, and seeking the wrong type of loan can be considered fraud. This is getting ridiculous, the banker said. His mortgage colleagues told him to drop his concerns, the people said. They didn't want to deal with pushback from a financial advisor who managed the client's wealth assets. After the mortgages were given out, the banker would look up the properties online. He found some structures had been knocked down and others had undergone renovations and were for sale, the people said. In Morgan Stanley units catering to wealthy clients, there is tension between the financial advisors tasked with managing these high rollers And the mortgage employees who feel pressured to set aside concerns to help keep them happy, according to current and former employees, emails, and other internal documents. The Wall Street Journal also reviewed a whistleblower's complaint filed with federal regulators by another employee. Mortgage employees face backlash from their bosses, financial advisors, and others in the wealth department when they delay loan approvals or reject them, the people said. Even if they won a fight and a loan wasn't made, former employees said they felt financial advisors, who are compensated when their clients get new mortgages, could affect their feedback, performance reviews, and bonuses, the people said. Band of Socialists sows panic in Democratic Party. Once a fringe wing, the movement is wielding surprising political power. By James Finelli, Joshua Chafin, Eliza Collins, and Kevin T. Dugan. Megan Romer likes to spend her free time sewing costumes for school plays, picking blackberries in her backyard in rural Cayuga County, New York, and watching her partner play the fiddle in folk bands. In her day job, she is seeking to overthrow capitalism. Romer, 42 years old, is the national co-chairwoman of the Democratic Socialist of America, the far-left organization whose candidates have swept to victory in several recent high-profile races by preying on Democratic incumbents. The next showdown comes next Tuesday when congressional primaries in Missouri and Michigan again pit Democratic Socialists against incumbent Democrats. This is what we've been building toward, Romer said. Already, the DSA's advances are stirring consternation and sometimes panic among mainstream Democrats, dreading their own Tea Party moment in which a radical fringe hijacks the party and taints their brand, just as they are trying to appeal to swing voters to win control of Congress in November's midterms. This month, the DSA called for defunding the Defense Department, abolishing police, and getting rid of the Senate, and replacing the President and Supreme Court with representatives chosen by and subordinate to Congress. The DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, poses a fundamental threat to the Democratic Party and to the nation as a whole. Based on their own platform, they are working to undermine our society, our economy, and our form of government organization, including our Constitution, said Jamie Metzl, a veteran of the Clinton National Security Council and State Department. Once a baby boomer relic, the DSA now counts more than 120,000 members, about half of whom joined since late 2024, after Israel's war in Gaza ignited campus protests nationwide. Some want to dismantle prisons and overturn America's free market system. Some yearn to fulfill progressive promises like Medicare for all. And then there are those who are simply attracted by Zoran vibes, as one member put it, of DSA star and New York Mayor Zoran Mandani, who has been hyping up a new Piatir tax as a big win for his push to get the wealthy to pay more. As a point of clarification, a pied-à-terre is someone who owns or rents a house or an apartment, but does not live in it full time. In New York, the base of America's two most powerful establishment Democrats, Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, a trio of congressional candidates endorsed by Mandani and the DSA, won Democratic primaries in June, upsetting two long-standing incumbents in the process. One of the victorious DSA candidates was arrested just last year for protesting outside Schumer's Manhattan office over U.S. military aid to Israel. The DSA insurgents also claimed recent victories in Pennsylvania and Colorado, with all eyes now on races in Detroit and St. Louis on Tuesday. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, Dr. Fauci takes the fifth, alas. The pandemic oracle is getting the scrutiny he dodged during COVID. Anthony Fauci's decision to invoke his Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself before the Senate on Wednesday is a shame. The public could have benefited from his exchanges with senators, even if they would have been contentious. Senator Rand Paul has been investigating the government's response to COVID, and Dr. Fauci was at the center of the decisions to close schools and lock down the economy for months. President Biden granted Dr. Fauci a preemptive pardon, but Mr. Paul said that wouldn't protect him if he lies to Congress. Dr. Fauci blamed the senator for an unhinged obsession with him and decided on silence as a strategy. Mr. Paul is too set on criminalizing policy differences in our view, and Dr. Fauci doesn't belong in jail on any evidence we've seen. But Senator Paul deserves credit for digging into the truth about the government's destructive COVID response, especially the effort by Dr. Fauci and others to stifle dissenting views and hide the record. It is a crime to destroy federal records, Mr. Paul told Dr. Fauci on Wednesday. Yet our investigation reveals your assistant diligently reported that she deleted tons of emails. In 2024, you testified that you did not delete federal records. Who's telling the truth, you or your assistant? The committee has obtained repeated instructions from you telling federal officials to delete communications, Mr. Paul added. On February 2nd, 2020, one day after a conference call on COVID-19 origins, you told then National Institutes of Health Director Francis Collins, please delete this email after you read it. It would be good to hear Dr. Fauci respond. We know from previous disclosures that Drs. Fauci and Collins tried to demean the authors of the 2020 Great Barrington Declaration that favored focused protection on the old and sick rather than wholesale lockdowns. The dual favored media censorship of those and other dissenting views. Dr. Fauci might not be facing this tough scrutiny now if he and the press hadn't worked so hard to stifle COVID debate at the time. The doctor's recently released diaries reveal how much the media abandoned its skepticism and curiosity to elevate Dr. Fauci as the oracle who couldn't be doubted on COVID. On July 28, 2020, George Stephanopoulos interviewed Dr. Fauci on ABC's Good Morning America, and the host offered an easy opening for Dr. Fauci to rebuff criticism by President Trump. After the appearance, Dr. Fauci's diary records a text message from Mr. Stephanopoulos saying, "Thank you, Tony. So impressive." The diary records a June 10, 2021, recently nice conversation with Chuck Todd, then host of NBC's Meet the Press, about how to respond to criticism from conservative media figures. "Chuck is really an excellent journalist," Dr. Fauci wrote, "and although he must maintain his objectivity and reporting, it is very clear that he is really being a friend in understanding the difficult position that I am in." Speaking of a friend, there's CNN's Jake Tapper. In Dr. Fauci's telling, Mr. Tapper was an enthusiastic participant in his image building. On April 12, 2020, Dr. Fauci created a stir when he told Mr. Tapper in an interview that more lives would have been saved if the country had locked down sooner. This brought criticism from Mr. Trump and others, and Dr. Fauci was worried. On April 13th, his diary records a phone call with Jake Tapper. "Jake wanted to make sure the interview did not cause me any problems." On April 16th, 2020, Dr. Fauci records a text message from Mr. Tapper following the doctor's appearance on Laura Ingraham's show on Fox News. "Hard to believe Paula Ingraham went to Dartmouth, isn't it? All of us alumni are very proud." On May 14, 2020, Dr. Fauci records Mr. Tapper and fellow CNN personality Chris Cuomo running interference for him in another feud with Mr. Trump. Journalists need sources, and friendships aren't uncommon. But the conformist media idolatry of Dr. Fauci was a way of shutting off debate over COVID policy. It also became a way for the press to attack President Trump in an election year. Locking down debate over COVID was as damaging as the lockdowns. Also from the editorial page, Mandani's Class Enemies List. He publishes the names and addresses of his new property tax targets. New York Mayor Zoran Mandani's warmth of collectivism is giving way to, well, something with a different temperature. The mayor rolled out his new P-A-TER tax by publishing the names and addresses of some 960,000 people who could have to pay. "Nothing like publicly stigmatizing your class enemies, comrade." Governor Kathy Hochul this spring indulged Mr. Mandani's socialist cadres by signing a tax on second homes in New York City. The measure targets ultra-wealthy, out-of-city residents and global elites who use New York City real estate as a vehicle for wealth storage rather than as homes, he said in April. The mayor named and shamed hedge fund manager Ken Griffin for owning a $238 million penthouse. That was a nasty personal attack, but a misdirection. The tax applies to townhouses worth more than $5 million, as well as condos and co-ops
valued at more than $1 million. According to the city government's obtuse methodology, and rates are steep. Condo and co-op owners will have to pay a 4% annual tax on property valued from $1 million to $3 million, and $625,000 on those over $5 million. That's a $100,000 annual bill, not including ordinary property tax levies, on a $2.5 million condo. Non-residents with second homes generally still have to pay New York State income tax if they work for employers or manage a business based in the city. While the tax putatively applies only to non-primary residences not occupied or leased, there's no simple way for the city to determine this based on its records on file. Wealthy non-residents often have to go to great lengths to demonstrate to tax collectors that they aren't domiciled in the city. Now New Yorkers will have to do likewise to prove they live in the city. Late last week, the city posted a searchable database of some 960,000 properties, accounting for 87% of non-rental properties, and sent letters to owners warning they could be hit with the tax. The city website says people who receive letters must submit information showing that the property is not subject to the surcharge. They have a month to do so. Did Mr. Mandani time the letters for when New Yorkers might be on vacation? Don't be surprised if Mr. Mandani soon calls for extending the pied-à-terre tax to primary homes of wealthy New Yorkers. During his campaign, he called for decommodifying housing, a euphemism for ending private property ownership, and confiscatory taxes are one way to do it. In related news, Mr. Mandani's legal advisor, Ali Najmi, who also serves as a special counsel at the personal injury firm Lyakis Law, said this week he plans to file a lawsuit against the city for the tragic death of a teenage tourist in a horse carriage accident in Central Park. Mr. Najmi leads the mayor's committee that appoints judges to city courts. Conflict of interest? Several insurers have filed racketeering lawsuits against Lyakis for allegedly conspiring with doctors to fabricate and exaggerate injuries. The firm denies the claims. The warmth of collectivism in action. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, Who's Afraid of the DSA? Mark Kelly and Tim Kaine can't find the courage to oppose their party's radicals. By Carl Rove. The Democratic Party's leadership could easily be overrun by the Democratic Socialist of America. Normal Democrats had better keep that from happening. Democrats are obviously afraid. On Meet the Press Sunday, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly was asked if he agreed with New York Mayor Zoran Mandani that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal who should be arrested while attending the United Nations General Assembly. Mr. Kelly sidestepped the issue. He said he was not happy with Mr. Netanyahu's decisions and hoped He loses Israel's October elections. That was timid, but at least he didn't endorse Mr. Mandani's arrest threat. Virginia Senator Tim Kaine took a different approach during an interview on Fox News Sunday. Hillary Clinton's 2016 running mate welcomed the Democratic Socialist and even tried to make their extreme position more palatable. Fox News anchor Shannon Breen asked Mr. Kaine about an article in The Atlantic that called the DSA a parasite and warned the left-wing faction is hijacking the Democratic Party. In response, Mr. Kaine praised his party for having always been known, and mostly this is good, sometimes it's not, as a big tent. He then rejected litmus test for DSA members. Neutral wasn't enough for the Old Dominion's junior senator. He then said that many DSA members he knows don't want to abolish the Senate, presidency, or U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They merely want reforms and effective border policies. In fact, the organization's platform calls for defunding what it calls the Department of War and abolishing the Senate, ICE, national borders, and the police and prison system, as well as having a unicameral Congress choose the president and all federal judges. Mr. Kaine surely knows all this, but he doesn't want to offend the DSA or alienate voters who find their views repugnant, so he pretends not to see their radicalism. That will embolden them. Some wise Democrats acknowledge the danger the DSA represents. Recently, two sons of Chicago, Bill Daley and Rahm Emanuel, wrote in these pages about the DSA threat to their party's viability. Another politician who appears willing to take on this fight is Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. When asked about Daria Liza Avila Chevalier, who defeated the incumbent in a New York congressional primary, he was blunt. He didn't think she was someone he would agree with on many things or share similar values. She ran, he observed, as a socialist. It wasn't a compliment. Mr. Shapiro saw Ms. Chevalier's victory and the DSA's other primary wins as a call to action. He said the Democrats haven't had a battle over what we believe in since 1992. In that year, Democrats had been trounced in three straight presidential elections. After running for the nomination in 1984 and 1988, the Reverend Jesse Jackson sought to be a kingmaker in 92. At a June conference of Jackson's Rainbow Coalition in Washington, Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton made his move. The Washington Post had recently run an interview with the rap artist Sister Soulja, who said, "If black people kill black people every day, why not have a week and kill white people?" The day before Mr. Clinton was to appear at the Rainbow Coalition, he learned that Sister Soulja had done so as well. With Jackson sitting immediately to his left, Mr. Clinton said the rapper's remarks were filled with a kind of hatred that you do not honor, adding, "If you took the words white and black and reversed them, you might think that David Duke was giving that speech." Afterward, a visibly upset Jackson defended the rapper as misunderstood, and criticized Mr. Clinton for very bad judgment in raising the issues. The Clinton campaign credited the controversy with helping him win the general election. It signaled to voters he was mainstream, sane, strong, and unafraid of a fight. Democrats would benefit from a sister soldier moment in which a party leader unequivocally opposes the DSA. He would be assailed by the DSA as an establishment sellout, but pusillanimously silence or equivocation is worse. There's real energy among the socialists. Their candidates are winning primaries. They have a take-no-prisoner approach, and they want control. In a narrowly polarized America, a DSA takeover would drag Democrats to defeat in battleground districts and states. If Democrats like Messrs. Kane and Kelly can't find the courage to stand up to the DSA, a debacle awaits their party. Restorative justice brings violent schools. Why would anyone think you could discipline bullies by inviting them to talk about their feelings? By Tony Woodleaf. The Education Department will no longer count racial disparities in K-12 school suspension rates as proof of discrimination, it announced on July 23rd. This is a welcome change, but it won't automatically restore order in the thousands of schools pressured by the Obama and Biden administrations into adopting alternative discipline methods whose chief objective is racial equity. Many such programs have come at the cost of school safety and education. These methods go by many names, like restorative practices, social-emotional learning, and most telling, restorative justice. In lieu of suspensions, administrators invite offenders to reflect in a soothing place on the feelings and trauma that led them, say, to hit another student or disobey a teacher. Students may also be invited into a restorative circle with school staff and other students, where they can share their feelings and others in the circle can talk with them about how peace in the community might be restored. Reality often falls short of this vision. Concerns about restorative justice emerged soon after the Obama administration began pushing it. Public schools in Philadelphia that implemented it experienced skyrocketing truancy, serious misbehavior, and declining achievement. Manhattan Institute researchers observed in 2017. Other cities experienced similar results. If any school district needed help diverting struggling children from a path that begins with school suspensions and ends in prison, it was the Little Rock School District in Arkansas. Its schools serve a student community that is 57% Black in a community whose 2024 Black out-of-wedlock birth rate was 80%, where nearly three-quarters of students come from low-income households, and roughly the same percentage fall below grade level in reading and math, according to 2024-25 data. During the 2021-22 school year, before its wide-scale adoption of restorative justice, this district of roughly 20,000 students had almost 2,500 instances of violence, bullying, and weapons infractions. Who could blame LRSD for forming a partnership with the Tenjanji Community Development Corporation, which claims its alternative discipline methods promote cohesion among students and administrators while fostering a growth mindset and positive relationships. LRSD engaged Tenjanji in 2022, paying it almost $1.5 million between 2023 and 2025 alone to provide digital, social, emotional learning tutorials, on-site peer mediation, and restorative circles, among other services. What followed was a catastrophe. Since the 2021-22 school year, district-wide assaults by students on other students have jumped 118%. Assaults by students on teachers and staff have climbed 151%. In a January 2026 meeting, LRSD board members learned that despite their heavy investments in restorative justice, Black male students, who make up 29% of LRSD students, commit 54% of disciplinary infractions. Two board members implied teacher racism must have caused the disparity. Another said teachers needed to try harder at restorative justice. None questioned whether their discipline philosophy is flawed. Alternative discipline proponents stress that restorative justice means school officials must no longer deliver consequences to misbehaving students. Instead, they must explore restoration with them. Restoration in this context means considering the emotions and trauma that led to the offender's behavior, giving him the opportunity to express his feelings, asking him to reflect, often in a calming room or corner, and only then, at least in some cases, inviting him to make peace with his victims. Unfortunately, it offers too many others a free pass to disrupt classrooms and hurt students and teachers. Our continuing nationwide scan of school system practices has uncovered more than 600 school districts comprising more than 9,200 schools in 41 states that openly practice alternative discipline methods. My hope as a father is that these schools selectively and appropriately apply these methods to help make children safer. But the willful ignorance so many school administrators exhibit when confronted with evidence of harm leaves me skeptical. That's why we're calling on school board members, state lawmakers, governors, and state attorneys general to investigate these practices in their jurisdictions and verify that children and their teachers are being helped, not endangered. If the opposite turns out to be true, parents and voters know how to hold state and community officials accountable. November is coming. Mr. Woodleaf is president of Federalism in Action. You've been listening to the reading of articles and features from the July 30th issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine, and have a wonderful day or evening, and enjoy the weekend.